This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name, as always, is Alex Perney. Today, we are very pleased to welcome on Cassidy Munson, president of Munson Collins Builders. And we're going to be kind of talking about some interesting ways of looking at personal assets, and specifically maybe for people a little bit more located in tech corridors, think Austin, San Francisco, your Miami's, New York's, Chicago's, that are, you know, kind of receiving a lot of benefit from their jobs, but maybe aren't necessarily happy with the kind of benefit that offers, and maybe some different trajectories that you can go by utilizing maybe some things like stock option benefits or just money that you've been receiving to invest in things that are going to not only maybe give you a, you know, better, you know, position by having, you know, tangible assets and, you know, shock for this podcast is going to be focused on real estate, but also, again, just kind of maybe the mindset on why maybe a transition away from just a, you know, hard line dollar, you know, dollar cost average versus, you know, having something that, you know, again, makes you feel better might be a good fit. Cassidy, I'm really pleased to have you on with us today. The, you know, I'm always happy when we have people on that can give a little bit of a different perspective. You know, so much of this podcast is taken up and by no means a bad way with, you know, stuff that's a little bit more just kind of fits into buckets. Like, hey, you know, why is commercial real estate great? Well, it offers X return. Here's how these things are structured. Here's how you can invest in this. And it's all kind of just funneling back to, at the end of the day, it's like, hey, how can I make more money? Which is not a bad thing. You know, we're an investment firm. Everyone's, you know, gotta live and wants to live their best life. So I'm excited to talk to you. So maybe give us a little bit of background about yourself and kind of how you kind of came to be in the position you're in. And, you know, we'll jump into the topics at hand from there.
Great. Well, first off, thank you so much, Alex, for having me today. I'm a fan of the podcast. And so getting an opportunity to be with you is exciting for me, and look forward to getting into some of the details. But yeah, to start with, my background, really how I got into residential construction, and that's really been my career as a residential builder, general contractor, is a family business. So my grandfather was a developer in the Central Valley. And when my father first got married and needed a job to support his family, he went to work for my grandfather cleaning up job sites, and slowly worked his way up in the business, and then started his own construction firm in 1977, which, when I graduated college in 2004, was really excited that I got to come to work with my dad. And much like him, started driving the trailer and the Bobcat around, cleaning up job sites, cleaning up all kinds of crazy things under houses, and really learning every trade on the way up the ladder. Became a project manager for him, general manager, and then subsequently I became the licensed contractor and owner of the firm. So we're a small boutique residential contracting firm. We're in Saratoga, California, which is a little hamlet in the Silicon Valley. So as you spoke to, yeah, most of our clients are working in the tech sector. And we really specialize in additions, remodels, and new home construction.
Okay, great. So it's, you know, you have this background, you know, firmly rooted in construction. So, you know, I'll kind of let you branch off from the first one. Why do you think that people necessarily, you know, maybe are kind of disenfranchised with just kind of getting that, you know, big fat, you know, check or those stock options? You know, what kind of trajectory differences do you see in that you've helped people with, you know, in your career to kind of realize some different options and why maybe trading one for another might be beneficial?
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting. So I really became involved with my dad's operation, let's say around the year 2000. And so I've been through two or three bubbles in the valley, like starting with the dot-com bubble and then bust of that. Then we had the pre-08 real estate bubble and the bust after that. And then, of course, we've been through what we went through with the pandemic and the boomerang effect that we experienced after that. And so like in a lot of ways, even though I'm very, I mean, I'm invested in the stock market, but just as my lead flow goes, I am always hyperly aware of what's going on in the tech sector and the stock market. And I can, it's an interesting experience. I'm old enough now. I remember when I did a lot of work for people that worked at like yahoo.com and pets.com back in the, in the dot-com bubble. And so what I found, and I think that it's really true, particularly in the Bay Area, you know, Bay Area real estate is incredibly valuable. And it's an interesting process for home ownership in this area because it is so expensive. You know, nobody really ever pays off their mortgage. It's like, because the average home here often, I think in San Jose, it's almost $2 million. And the neighborhoods we work in, starter homes are about $5 million. So everybody is doing everything they can to get into the market and then hope that the value, the property like increases in value so that you have equity that when you sell, you have some equity built up for the next house. And so that's where the advantage is for a lot of my clients. When we do new additions or build new ADUs, they're really investing in this property that it's a great investment because it's some of the most valuable real estate in the world. And they're able to really increase the value of their asset. You had a question, Alex?
No, yeah, that definitely makes... Sorry, yeah, you're just... you were paused a little bit there. I think the connection just froze a little bit, which... I would assume maybe it's on my end, considering you probably have pretty good internet where you're at in California, I would hope.
I try. But really, to get back to your question about diversifying assets. So what I've seen with all these roles in the market is the clients that are able to take their stock options out. Like, it's a great example of my clients that worked at Yahoo. In 2004, whatever Yahoo was at the peak of their valuation, by taking, you know, options out and investing it in their additions on their home, they were able to, you know, diversify those assets. And of course, as we know, I mean, Yahoo is no longer even in existence, or if it is, I'm not even sure if it's traded. It's certainly not traded at the way it was. So it's a great way, you know, for them to diversify their assets. And unlike, you know, commercial real estate investing, they get to enjoy it too. Like, they have nicer homes, larger homes. They have homes that are able to, you know, raise a family in and in good neighborhoods with good schools. So it is kind of a unique opportunity as an investment.
Sure. Now, you know, specifically kind of to your area, what are some potential issues that people run in when they try to go from converting these, you know, option portfolios into something more tangible like real estate? Are there some kind of unique across the board issues that people run into? And like with anything, you know, I'm sure there's success and there's, you know, failure is maybe a strong word, but maybe some drawbacks to this as well.
Sure. Yeah, I think of two cases that are uniquely different, but actually kind of similar. I won't say the name of the company, but we had a client that was working in a firm that is directly tied to the pandemic. And it was a stock that like blew up because of the pandemic and all of us working remotely. And, you know, sometimes in the Valley, what you see with these explosions of value, it's almost like a merry-go-round. I mean, it's people that maybe were living with roommates and all of a sudden they have this immense wealth. But it's all on paper because it's in an option and they're restricted. They can only sell so much at a certain time. And this client was able then to purchase a really good valued home that was in need of a lot of work. And invested a couple million into it with a new custom house. So she probably put about 5 million in, and today it's worth over 8. And thank God she did it, because that stock has lost 80% of its value. And so by her taking that money out, she was really able to solidify that wealth that otherwise would have been lost. In the market.
Okay, so from the example that you gave of someone that, you know, was very thankful in the aspect of, you know, it losing so much value that, you know, the reposition into a more stable asset definitely makes sense. I think that's probably going to be a little bit of a recurrent theme before we get into the next illustration that you have, for example, is that the nature of real estate could be something that kind of helps to buffer people out of the boom and bust culture that is technology. We're all familiar with it. You know, not everything can be a Microsoft or an IBM, has been blue chip status since the 80s. A lot of these newer tech startups, with the way that they work, you know, hopefully you're going for an acquisition, but if you're particular trajectory doesn't come to fruition, then you might just be holding something that's not worth the paper that it's printed on. So being able to transition from one thing into something a lot more tangible, that's not just cash, that has an appreciable value and also offers you utility and the fact that you can live somewhere, should be something that I think is, you know, for people, especially in the tech sector, should be something worth examining. So to that, any thoughts? And then also, let's go into your next example that you have.
Sure. Yeah, everything you said is exactly correct. And it's, I think I've did the math, Alex. So over the last 20 to 25 years that I've been doing this, I believe I've built around 500 homes, which means I've probably estimated over 2,000 houses. And in 98% of those cases, it's tech workers liquidating stock options to do the work. So it is definitely a proven and tried and true strategy. There's no doubt about that. It's interesting, though, the other thing that I was going to speak to, the other example is, and people forget that Apple, like at one point when Steve Jobs was first fired, and when he first came back, when they first launched the new line of Macintosh computers, Apple's stock was low. Like, it was actually a weak stock before Steve Jobs came back and invented the iPhone and the iPod and all these new technologies. And I had a client of mine that actually worked at Apple at that time, was hired. And so he had options. I don't quote me. I think the number was as low as $15 or $20 a share where he got Apple's options. And around 15 years ago, they finally were maturing to the point where he could sell them. And so they were going to be able to buy their first home. And he definitely could have afforded a much nicer neighborhood, but the schools that the kids were in, they were really tied into. And so he kind of intentionally bought in more of a moderately priced neighborhood and way overspent. Like, we tore this house down to the studs, just a normal California ranch. And me and this client built it on site. He was an engineer at Apple. So every angle, I remember making a huge compass with a rope in the driveway so that he could have the exact curvature of his trim above his garage. And little things, family photos and trinkets and time capsules, all kinds of neat things that went into this house. And he intentionally knew he was overspending for the neighborhood. And at the time, I remember remarking as you drove down the block, it was like, oh, yeah, that's the nicest house, which never probably a good investment to be the nicest house on the block. But luckily, 15 years later, I was over there meeting with them because they're friends of mine. And he was remarking that the real estate value had increased and he had made probably about $1 million in equity over the last 15 years. And I said, well, that's great news. And then he paused and he said he did a study of the value of the stock that he sold to build this house. And it was north of $30 million that if he would have held on to the stock, it'd be worth today. And my face turned white. I gulped. I said, I can't believe that. I'm so sorry. And he said, no, it was the best money I ever spent because he was able to have a house with no mortgage that he knew was built to quality and it was safe. And that if anything ever happened to him over the last 15 years, his wife and sons were going to be taken care of. And that was really the best gift he ever had. So it's a unique thing where we have this question of value, right? There's the ROI, the dollars and cents, and then there's also the peace of mind. And
yeah,
he's able to get that.
That's most often overlooked, I think, especially when it comes to investing in real estate, more towards the specifics of, you know, personal homes as well. You know, I think a lot of the time that, you know, at least what I, you know, talk about so much is just the investment side of things. And, you know, yes, is buying your own home an investment? Sure, but not necessarily in the same context of saying, okay, well, I own this single family home and that one and this one. You know, investments are something that you typically want to have, you know, some liquidity and some able to transact with them. You know, typically people don't look at their primary residence as a transactable item, but it definitely offers more utility than just a dollars and cents. It offers security. It offers utility. It offers, you know, an actual peace of mind that a lot of other things don't necessarily do. So in this case, you know, the monetary value of, and that's painful to look at, of saying, you know, how much in lost, you know, potential earnings he had. I mean, that's, you know, what if the math on what you're telling me is right, that's like $900,000 a year in lost income if you were to amortize that over the ownership of that home. So yeah, that's a tough one.
It's a common occurrence, right? You hear it all the time in the Valley. And, you know, it's because most of the time it's wise to diversify. It doesn't make sense to keep all of your assets into one stock. But there are the Amazons of the world and the Apples of the world and the Teslas of the world where, you know, the value has gone up so much, it can be painful. But most of the time, it doesn't work. Most of the, like, right, a lot of time it's pets.com where the stock is no longer worth as what it was at its height.
Yeah, and that's also something to kind of keep in mind is that, you know, if when you transition into a more tangible asset class like real estate, you don't, even if the bottom drops out, you know, there's never, let's say, you know, it's never going to happen, but let's say the property is worth zero. Well, you can still use it. I mean, if you have stock that's worth zero, I mean, you could burn it for heat. It doesn't really apply down here in Florida, maybe in California, depending on, you know, where in the world you are. But, you know, it's something that offers utility. And again, I think everyone understands real estate's never going to be worth zero. Owning my house, you know, it's like, I don't really necessarily care what the value is if I'm not trying to sell it. You know, it could be worth $100,000. It could be worth $600,000. I prefer that unless I want to sell it, it's worth $100,000. So I save on the taxes, which would be nice. But unfortunately, I live in a very popular area of Florida. So that hasn't happened. But I mean,
yeah, it's interesting. You know, even in 2008, when we had the worst real estate market in my lifetime in the Bay Area, most of the neighborhoods that we work in, they actually even still appreciate it. I mean, it was just, they slowed down. And mm-hmm. and then even in the lower cost neighborhoods around here, they plateaued. But we saw very little loss. I mean, maybe a random, you know, house on the, in a very bad neighborhood, like people were going to get foreclosed. But even in 2008, you know, there was still a pretty good market because people have money. They may have taken it out of the stock market. They took it out of real estate, but they still had liquidity. And so people want to live in Palo Alto. There's really good schools. There's really good jobs that they can drive to. It's a really attractive place to be.
For sure. Now, you know, nothing is always, you know, sunshine and rainbows. The, you know, big kind of caveat to a lot of this is saying, okay, well, one, the real estate is, you know, going to be very expensive. And, you know, granted, maybe you do have a large share of stock or stock options that you could liquidate or redeem that would help to get you in there. But, you know, one, you have to have the money to purchase or for the down payment and then renovation constructions, but especially, you know, very, very concerning to people in your part of the country is governmental regulations. You know, even in somewhere like Florida, where we have, you know, relatively, you know, lax regulations, especially the closer you get to the coast and we have so many wetlands and different things like that, you still run into a lot of stuff. Again, maybe not as onerous, but, you know, you still have a ton of different stuff here between, you know, state, federal, local governments that can really be a hassle. So maybe let's speak a little bit to the potential roadblocks, because I would imagine most of these people want to buy as cheap as possible and customize things to their liking, especially kind of in the context of what you do and home remodels, new builds and things like that. That's certainly something that you run into.
Sure. Yeah, it's extraordinary. I'm in a round table, a peer mentorship group. So I meet with companies of my same size and business model from all over the country twice a year. And it always blows my mind. It almost feels like we're in different businesses when I speak to people from Florida or Texas, particularly Texas, where there is very little regulation in regards to the hoops that we have to go through in California for entitlement and permit approval. So speaking from the residential end, it's only gotten worse like over the last 20 years as the population has grown and there's been more restrictions put in. Generally, what makes the Bay Area real estate so valuable in a lot of ways is our geography is we're kind of hemmed in between by the ocean, the bay, and Greenland that we can't develop into. And so it's one of the reasons why our real estate is so expensive. Now, one benefit that's happened over the last, let's say, 10 years is in response to the housing crisis, California as a state has taken measures to grant what we call ADU development to make it easier to get approved for homeowners. Generally, we all have these little hamlets. You know, I probably work in 15 different municipalities, each one with their own planning code. It's one of the reasons you should hire a custom builder with experience in the neighborhood, because we have relationships and we know ways to get things done. But it's definitely, it's a hindrance to homeowners trying to develop their properties. This ADU designation has been really helpful because it actually, it is an overplant over the entire state of California so that each municipality has to now follow the same zoning and building code for these ADU projects. So we've seen a lot of uptick in that. And, you know, there's a myriad of reasons to do these ADUs. One of them, of course, is the fact that we have very many multi-generational families. We have people that have their parents move here and help raise the kids. So ADUs are great developments for them because it gives them privacy, but also everybody's kind of there helping raise the kids and also helping pay the mortgage. And then also the ADU can be great asset for income. A lot of people, you know, where your mortgage is so high every month, it's great to be able to have a rental income on the property. And so that's been a great thing in the last few years. And it keeps getting better. Like the state keeps making improvements to the code.
Now, do you run into any particular issues with like utilization? I know at least here in Florida, especially in my area of the world, anything that increases density or kind of takes money out of the tourism industry or hotels or anything like that, and the rental markets are pretty heavily regulated on what can and can't be rentals in a lot of places. Do you ever run into that, especially in the ADU market? And that would be kind of interesting from the context of someone thinking, it's like saying, hey, this thing's got a big backyard, small house, I can stick an ADU back there and create some additional income, not only have a house, but also create an additional income stream. What kind of particular issues are circulating regarding that when it's not just you know, personal residence use and you're getting into kind of more of a business aspect for those?
Yeah. And this is a case where we have two different opinions within, let's say, the government. So we have our local municipalities. Like here, I'm in this small hamlet of Saratoga. And Saratoga is, without a doubt, is a single family resident neighborhood. Like these are all single family homes. You know, usually people have lived in them for many years. And so the challenge that the state has is the state is trying to mandate more density throughout the entire state of California. So the state of California would agree with everything you just said. Yes, please buy property with large backyards and put in rentals. so that we can have more housing density in the suburban neighborhoods. And then you have a lot of pushback from the existing homeowners in these neighborhoods that are questioning, what is the future of these suburban residencies? And I know in Southern California, there's been issues, San Francisco. There's something called the builder's recourse or the builder solution, where if the cities don't get enough housing stock, then they actually lose their planning like rights. And the state of California will just grant building permits for the builders that will get more housing landed. So it's gotten bad, Alex. I mean, this has been an issue for 30, 40 years in California. The state is wanting to get the cities to allow more density, and they're starting to take more and more steps to really regulate that so we can have more housing stock.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're telling me the state is circumventing the local municipalities and issuing building permits to residents directly?
They're forcing them to issue building permits. In California, we have basically two rounds of approvals. You have planning approval and then building, which is looking at, is this building to code? Is the engineering correct? Is it safe for human occupancy? Mm-hmm. So with the ADUs, California has allowed us is basically we no longer have to go through that planning approval process. Okay. If it's a designated ADU, we can go straight into building.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, no, it's definitely pretty interesting. And do you get any type of pushback afterwards? I mean, I imagine if they get the building permit, what about utilization of these things? Single family versus, again, those ADUs being utilized as rentals. Is there any type of additional pushback? You get the hand forced permit by the state, and then I'd imagine that governments can tend to hold a grudge sometimes. So, if the big state of California is telling the city of Saratoga they have to do something, any other type of bureaucratic red tape that you've seen people run into?
Oh, sure. And I've seen this in real time. This has been going on now for years, where the cities then try to change the building code to make it more restrictive to get an ADU built. Mm-hmm. And then there's lawsuits. There's people that have gone to court. Montesorino is another municipality here, and they lost. And they're having to change their code so that it concurs with the state of California's code. We had another law called SB9 that got passed that also lifted the single family residency code for the entire state. So any lot can now be multifamily.
That's interesting. Now, does that building code specifically only apply up to anything that's deemed non-commercial, so four or less conjoined units?
Yeah, and really the way they've written all the laws from the very beginning, and I'm actually in favor of this, that they realized early on that this could be maybe, I don't want to say misappropriated, but they wanted to make sure that this was really aiding homeowners and not developers necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the restrictions on the SB9 and the different ADU laws is that it does need to be owner occupied to do all this. I think I've seen in my real time with the ADUs we've built, I've never seen any neighbors pushback or complaints, partially because I think everybody is appreciating their opportunity.
For sure. And have you seen this kind of the SB9 stuff? Have you seen that create a rise in people doing teardowns and putting in a duplex or a triplex?
Yes. This is definitely all on the rise, and makes sense because, like I said, California is a very diverse state and almost a country. Sometimes we think we're our own country.
But well, you're very diverse. Your flag say Republic of California?
It does. Absolutely. We were a country before we were a state. So we are a very unique place. And I think the idea of multifamily or even just this idea of communal living too is really popular, that not everybody wants to have that nuclear family experience, where maybe you have two families that are friends could actually share the lot with a duplex. And you have kind of a built-in community that way and help with childcare and all those other tasks. So I've seen, especially with younger generations, I guess the way to look at this really is, yeah, if you're a baby boomer and you bought in the 80s, you're fine. But yeah, all my friends that graduated college in 2000 and afterwards, for us to stay in this area and still be homeowners, you have to be creative. And so these are all solutions that people are using to try to be creative so that we can still be in these neighborhoods and, you know, grow a family and have assets and live the American dream.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of, you know, pushing itself out into other locales as well. You know, specifically to where I live in Florida, you talk about geographically locked. I live on the peninsula of Tampa Bay. So it's the highest population density county in the state of Florida, which is kind of funny considering Miami's in this state. You wouldn't think that lowly old St. Pete, Florida and Pinellas County would have it. But I mean, you can drive from the bay to the Gulf and it's basically like driving through a neighborhood. You know, there's very little green space. There's building restrictions on building up a lot, especially since we have, you know, hurricanes, which are fun. So those things like to blow over big, tall buildings. So yeah, the necessitating kind of the difference in looking, I think, is important. And to your point about kind of bucking the trend of the, you know, traditional nuclear family and having more communal living is interesting. Now, from the context of what we're talking about in, you know, people shifting into looking at, you know, saying, hey, you know, I have this windfall of whatever I'm doing and maybe riding that roller coaster isn't the best idea to the real estate. Have you seen people gravitating towards this stuff that's been presented by what you said, SB9, to doing something where, yeah, I'm not a big fan of kitsch terms, but when they call like house hacking, you know, it's like live in one, rent out the other. You know, me being kind of the nuts and bolts, and I appreciate the, you know, creative investment side of things. You know, if you don't need a whole lot of space, and I don't, you know, my wife and I prefer to spend our money on things like travel and experiences versus a big house. You know, I live in a relatively smaller home. You know, if someone's kind of in that vein, like I am, you know, the attractiveness of having this windfall and saying, okay, well, I'll build a triplex, live in one, have the ability to have that asset that appreciates and generates income. Have you seen people gravitating towards that yet?
Absolutely. I would say every single one of our ADU projects that we do, and maybe at this point, it's 25% of the projects we do are either a standalone ADU or they have an ADU as a component. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes we are renovating the primary residence and adding an ADU at the same time to reorient the use of the lot. And it's interesting. I think one of the things I would say is we tend to be more of a custom, maybe a higher end builder. So for our projects, I don't have a lot of my clients that are looking necessarily to rent to the public, but they're using it so that they can have their parents come and live there or their aunts and uncles come and live there. It's so that you can have multi-generations of people or multiple family members living on one property.
Okay, but gotcha.
I do know I have friends of mine that work more in the medium and low-cost areas in San Jose particularly. And yeah, this is straight rental income. People are buying properties with, you know, smaller primaries with large yards and putting in, and we just changed the law. You can actually now have two ADUs for every primary residence. So you can actually turn a 7,000 square foot lot into your house and two rentals.
Yeah, and that's kind of funny. I would never at least think from the perspective, you know, it's there's two places that have so much in common, but are so diametrically different as California and Florida are. You know, it's like we both have a lot of coastline, a lot of similar like activities, but when it comes to like the government between the two, I mean, black and white is, you know, maybe about as stark of a contrast as you can get. But from that perspective, that seems like a lot more of a friendly, you know, zoning regulation than what we have in Florida. I mean, if you want to change population density or usage of a building here, especially in a residential neighborhood, good luck. It's just not happening. You know, especially in my neighborhood, I knew they tried to do a conversion of one house and they had everything done, but they wouldn't issue the certificate of occupancy. They just wouldn't. And there was lawsuits. And I think they actually lost because I think I saw them. again, I think they changed a few things. Like the only thing you can really do is like, if you have an existing structure, adding a, and it has to be detached. That's the thing too. So you mm-hmm. have to have an existing detached structure. So like my house, I have a detached garage, so I could potentially add a second story unit. The only other person I've seen do it in my neighborhood also had the same kind of thing. But as far as new building on a lot here, nope. Year, it's not happening. It's
just, well, I mean, we used to be that way.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm probably going to say something that the statute of limitation has run out, so I'm not worried. 20 years ago, I built a lot of wood shops. They had all the plumbing ready to go, and whatever the homeowners used it for when I left is up is their business. But it was that case in California. We were incredibly restrictive about zoning and not wanting to have second units. But I think two things happened. A, because of the cost of housing is so high, especially for our blue collar workers, they're living in these buildings. And so the city and the state said, okay, we can't turn a blind eye to this. Let's make sure it's safe and it's secure and it's good for human occupancy. So that was one, I think, major step that changed the regulation. And then two, it's just a housing crisis. I mean, we have historically, especially since 08, new builds have never gotten back up to the levels that they need in California. And so the state's trying their best they can through regulation to try to increase that.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of a pervasive problem too, when looking at the entire United States. Yes, they're building, permits have been at a high, compared to the past several years, but it's not for anything that people that need the housing can't afford, especially, where we're here in Florida, and not in my county, but south of us down where Sarasota and Bradenton are across the bay. It's, these huge housing developments, and you'll see all of them, and it's like, home starting at $550, home starting at $750. And, depending on where you're at in the country, that might be a bargain. But I think for anyone that's in the more blue collar, again, just not in that price bracket, irregard of what your profession is. It's just unattainable. It just really isn't, especially with what interest rates are today. I mean, you're talking about getting into something where you're going to have, PITI is going to be $4,100, $4,500 a month. How are you affording that on a household income of $80,000?
It's really amazing, Alex. We do something called EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System. Mm-hmm. And so I have a leadership team, and just yesterday we had our weekly meeting, and I kind of stated to the team, our biggest challenge for the next 10 years is housing for our employees, because more and more of my employees are having to move 2 hours out of this area to afford to buy a home. And the idea I came up with yesterday is we need to get creative. Like, we need to buy a piece of property somewhere and develop it where all of our employees can live there and have an equity stake in it, because there's just no way that we're going to be able to continue to operate with everybody living 2 hours away.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think as businesses, we need to start thinking about these challenges and creative solutions to it. And, another issue a lot of my younger employees have is childcare. So as business owners, let's think creatively. If we're going to develop property, let's find some childcare too, and really solve these issues so that our good employees don't move away. Because that's our biggest cost, is when you lose a really skilled, trained employee in your business.
And that's kind of an interesting facet that seems to come in ebbs and flows in the public consciousness, especially when it comes to housing and workforce, is that used to be a primary concern. Look back at the 70s and 80s, you saw a lot of childcare in, places where people actually worked and went to, and it's kind of gotten away from that. As far as I don't personally have children. So I can only speak to what I see anecdotally. I like to keep up on current events and things, but it seems like it's kind of gotten away from it. Now it's, we're having to deal with those particular issues. And again, having a workforce that's 2 hours away is problematic, especially in the trades. If you're building something, it's like, you can't, if you got the concrete guy coming, you can't have your guys coming, an hour later, they get stuck in traffic. They're dropping that concrete. They got to be there.
One of the interesting things, one of the reasons I'm so hawkish on my industry is because it's the last thing that will ever get outsourced. Like an AI can't ever take us over because you have to have someone hammering the nail. Mm-hmm. But with that, you're right. I can't zoom in the concrete contractor. Like some human has to be on site, and that human's probably a really skilled craftsman and blue collar. And we have to find a way to make sure that they can live in the same communities that we're building in.
And yeah, right absolutely. Now, it's not working. Yeah, and didn't you mention, I think, in the pre-call that you had some types of investments or what you were doing for some development that was kind of aimed at fixing that?
Yeah. You know, one of the things we've been, and I kind of touched on it earlier, that all of these new laws have been written to really be beneficial to owner-occupied property. And so as a investor in real estate, one of my theories is like, I don't try to compete with the big boys. I'd always rather be a cockroach. Like I'm not going to be Kaufman and Broad, and I'm not going to put in subdivisions. But if there's parcels that are available that are already in developed neighborhoods, like that's a great opportunity. And so one of the things we've been gearing towards is actually finding homeowners that have been in these neighborhoods for many years that have already bought in, and then partnering with them to develop their EDUs and their investments. So okay. Taking our skill set and our experience and partnering with those homeowners so we can utilize some of these new laws and create a better investment for them.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting that you're now kind of doing it on the outreach, which also helps to solve the additional problem. And again, ADUs, from what it sounds like, are pretty wide open when it comes to utilization, once you get it in there. So with specific, I think the ADU is kind of an interesting thing. I keep coming back to it because it's something that I think is valuable, especially for people looking to, augment, a particular property. And this can be supplanted in a lot of places. Certainly California seems to be a lot more friendly to them than a lot of other places. But, having an accessory dwelling unit might be a good option for a lot of people, especially when it comes to creating more income from a given asset. If you can not have to redevelop a whole thing and you have pre-approved engineering plans and can have something shot up pretty quickly, that's a pretty interesting concept to me. So I think that's kind of one of the things that I'd like, the listeners to think about is, it doesn't always have to be a ground up redevelopment of your property. If you have enough land, an ADU might be a viable option for increasing cash flows. And also from the, kind of where we started with the investment perspective of people liquidating stock options and stuff, there's a lot of, forgive the pun, but there's a lot of options when liquidating stock options for the property utilization. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's an emerging field. I mean, I just spent a few days in Las Vegas. We have an IBS show every year, International Building Show. And the entire parking lot was full of modular and prefab ADUs, ranging in the most rudimentary, which are basically shipping containers that are minute they're placed on your yard, they're done. There's the box, which Elon Musk lives in, which are pretty amazing because you press a button and the whole thing expands and it's done. And then there's some really nice, I'm a custom builder, so it's amazing I'm saying this, but there were some high quality modular homes that I saw at this show, and they're all geared towards this ADU market. Where a homeowner can add this secondary unit and it's a rental. And the great thing about the modular system, right, is you get the pad done, you get the utilities out there, it lands, it's done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's some pretty cool stuff. We're kind of getting up towards the end of our conversation today, and it's a little bit of a bummer because I really enjoy talking about like market specific stuff and current event type things. It's been a great conversation, Cassidy. Any kind of can't talk today. Any closing comments or anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to snag in there before we end this thing up?
Yeah, no, I just would like to say that I love my industry because I get the opportunity to work with people to build their idea of home for themselves and their families, and I want more and more people to be able to have that experience. And so I think as a country, let's think creatively about how we overcome these problems. And the solutions aren't going to be our parents' solutions. They're going to be the next generation solutions. And so I think a lot of people get down and depressed and think that there's no way that's why, like, the world is not as good as it was once. But, like, I think we can get it back there again if we all think creatively and work together.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, I really do appreciate you taking your time out of your day. The most valuable resource we all have is our time, because we can't make any more of it. So I do appreciate you being on with us today. And if you wouldn't mind, if people want to get in touch with you for what you have going on professionally or anything else, how can they reach you?
MunsonCollins.com.
All right. Well, fantastic. This has been another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name, as always, is Alex Perney, and have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.